WCRS 98.3 102.1. This is Fight Back with Bob Petrakis and Connie Goodell Newton.
Hi, Bob Petrakis here, and we're in the studio with Mary Jane Borden, who was just at a movie put on by the freepress.org, Columbus Institute for Contemporary Journalism, called American Drug War, and she's the perfect guest following that movie, which is highly recommended. I give it a large thumb up. I'm a large thumb man tonight, and I don't know what Connie Goodell Newton. Goodell says thumb up. Newton said thumb up, two thumbs up from Goodell and Newton. And Mary Jane Borden, the perfect after show guest, as the editor of Drug War Facts. And that movie had a lot of facts that would be shocking to the average American. What's going on in the drug war and why are facts important? Ronald Reagan once said facts were silly things.
Really?
Silly things. The facts are important because the drug war is largely driven, particularly in the media, by hyperbole and distortions. And so it's important for us to go to authoritative sources, to clinical reviews, clinical studies, to, in fact, government reports, to find out what is being reported statistically, what is being reported epidemiologically, and so on, so that we're making good decisions based upon what is true.
Well, are we making good decisions? I know Connie's always been a big fan of the prison industrial complex.
Actually, that was one of the first things that I was going to comment on after the movie, is there were some really interesting and kind of hard to watch images of police enforcement and prison. There was one image of a man with a sort of like mesh bag over his head who it wasn't clear. It seemed that he was in a drug induced state, but it also looked like he was being abused by police officers. So there were some really extreme images of, you know, police handling people who were on drugs. There were images of people in jail incarcerated. There was an image of, you know, kind of a bureaucrat in a tie who was responsible for running some of the prisons, and he was somebody who seems to have profited off of the drug war. It seems like the drug war and the prison industrial complex are big business.
How would you respond to that with your drug war facts? Is the prison industrial complex and the drug war, are certain people getting rich off it?
I would say certain people are getting rich, and certain people are, I think more importantly, using it as a way to secure power base, at least in my view. The more people that you incarcerate, the more people that have felony records, the more people that are disenfranchised from voting, obviously puts in place and keeps in place a certain power structure. And in my view, that is one of the principal purposes of the drug war. I think the sheriff you're talking about was that famous Sheriff Arpaio, I think is how you pronounce his name. He's from Maricopa County in Arizona. And he is a notorious drug warrior, for using that term. And I think using some very cruel strategies in order to manage these prisoners, in fact, housing them outside in, you know, 100-plus degree Arizona temperatures while they're putting dogs inside, in the cool temperatures of air conditioning, that seems a little over the top to me, and I think it would to anybody who has a human rights focus.
Well, last time I was in Tempe, Arizona, it was 120 degrees in the summer, so the thought about being outside in that weather in a tent seems to be, from my perspective, a violation of human rights. But he's very popular, and also we should add that he didn't come out against medical marijuana, which I found shocking for a man who seemed to be so reactionary. I thought that was one of the surprises in the movie, that people with cancer, people that were sick, He felt they should have access to medical marijuana.
It's interesting that he said that, because he says, well, they should be able to go get that drug from doctor's offices just like people get other drugs from doctor's offices.
And
well, the truth of the fact, is, no, you don't generally get drugs from doctor's offices. Now, your doctor may give you a few free samples to start out, but he will give you a prescription that you go get filled at a pharmacy. So if he is endorsing medical cannabis from the standpoint that it should be able to have a prescription that you get from, let's say, a pharmacy, better still, in my view, a dispensary, then maybe he is more enlightened than I gave him credit for.
Yeah, at least I was shocked by that. And where does marijuana fit into this? It seems like the start of the drug war, almost, that marijuana was the drug of the counterculture. And when Richard Nixon declared his war on drugs, marijuana in many ways was the key target.
And of course, I think if you want to disenfranchise a certain element of the population, why not go after people who are notably liberal in their points of view, notably against you politically? Mm-hmm. And if you incarcerate and disenfranchise enough of them, given felony records, then you cut out that whole portion of the voting population. And I think it reinforces that, again, that particular power structure.
Is the drug war racist?
Well, let me quote a statistic that just really gelled it for me. This comes from December 2009 Bureau of Justice Statistics report called Prisoners 2008. And in Prisoners 2008, it said that in 2006, because they always go back a couple years, they're analyzing data that's a couple years old. That's just the way it goes. So in that particular data year, there were 265,000 prisoners in state prisons on drug felonies. All right, 265,000 prisoners, roughly. All right, of those, 44% were African American and 21% were Hispanic. All right, now you add those two together and you have about two-thirds of the population of the prison prisoners there for drug charges who are African American and Hispanic. The problem with that statistic is that African Americans and Hispanics, if you combine their total U.S. populations together, make up only about a quarter of the population. Further to that, it is found that African Americans and Hispanic people, generally speaking, use alcohol and illicit drugs at a lower overall rates than the general population of society. So that would certainly tell me, number one, just case in point, point blank, that this is a racist policy. The drug war is racist.
Use less, busted more. Oh, any thoughts on that? I know it doesn't shock Connie Goodell Newton. That's why she went into law.
We have talked a little bit about how the drug war is racist, and that was definitely brought up in the movie. I also really, you know, any topic that I'm exploring, I also like to look at gender and how the topic affects, like, women versus men. And I know criminality in general has been something that generally has been targeted at men. Women, as they've been characterized, have been characterized as people who are not agents, people who can't do anything. So they can't possibly do something criminal. And in fact, like, when a woman committed a crime back before the women's movement, a lot of time her husband was held responsible for a crime. So that's just a little bit of background on kind of where I'm coming when I ask, like, how has the drug war been gendered? So if you look at, like, how it affects men and women differently or something like that, I mean, it seems like it's primarily targeted black men a lot in locking up men and keeping them from being fathers in their and being active in their communities. It seems like. Do you have any statistics on the gender?
Historically, it seems, if they go back to the 50s, it seems like you've targeted women for the pharmaceuticals, right? Or as the Stones used to say, mother's little helper. Right behind the door, she took four more, Valium, whatever the drug tranquilizer of the day is.
Going towards the criminality issue, before we go to the marketing issue, there are a few reports out there that really do go into this in depth. There's one called, I think, Prisoners and Their Children. I might not have the title of it quite right, but it basically goes in and looks at the prisoners in state and federal jails, prisons, what have you, who have young children. I think that's one way that women are particularly victims of the drug war, because women often come to an incarceration situation with children. You know, the woman doesn't necessarily stand alone. I mean, you're hopefully the woman is married and has a, you know, husband and all that. But oftentimes now, as we know nowadays, so many children are born out of wedlock. So often it's a single mom with children. And when a single mom goes to prison, her children essentially go to prison with her, because either they're separated from her, or in some cases, some prisons actually allow visitation, or in the first years of life, the child to live with the mother. But the still situation here is we're talking about an incarceration situation, which is a far, far cry from any type of a normal upbringing for a child.
That sounds absolutely awful. And I know that there are women who give birth in prison, and they may even be shackled to their bed while they're giving birth, you know, which is a horrible assumption that they have about you know, what makes somebody a criminal. A lot of times, you know, people are being sent to jail and, you know, being imprisoned for relatively, like, what should be minor crimes, or maybe they're political crimes, as Bob has explained.
Or medical problems, as Europe sees it, right?
I mean, they're criminalizing something.
Yeah, yeah. Instead of medicalizing it, are they not taking a medical problem, addiction?
Right.
And criminalizing in the United States.
So, you know, if I have a mental problem or a physical problem, should I really be imprisoned for that? I think the answer is clearly no, that there are other ways. You know, the crackhead in Netherlands was able to tell us. And honestly, I think, you know, maybe he had some good advice. Maybe we should listen to this guy from the movie who was in the film, who was he was about to smoke crack. It seemed like he had a pretty rational perspective. You know, pretty reasonable perspective. He said, no, you know, I think the laws in America are very harsh, that, you know, people need help. They need treatment, and that there are other ways to deal with that.
And there is help, if, as the movie said, if you're Betty Ford, you go.
Well, right. It's interesting to look at the patterns of treatment across the United States, because, and I don't have my computer in front of me to give you the finite statistic that I wish I could, but I want to say there's something on the order of 1,000 treatment centers, and you can go to Drug War Facts and find out exactly what that number is.
What's that website again?
www.drugwarfacts.org. In other words, Drug War Facts, all one word, .org. So you could go to Drug War Facts, and you could find out exactly what that finite statistic is. But what was interesting to me when I was reading some of the statistics about treatment was that most treatment is something that you have to pay for. And you have long lines to get into it because, you know, it's certainly when you use money as the benchmark, you know, he who has the dollars is obviously going to get in first. There's only about, let's say, 3 or 4, just a handful of treatment facilities in the United States that are free of charge. Now, what was interesting about the movie to me was that treatment in the Netherlands is free of charge. And I think that is powerful, because that means that if you're in trouble and you need to get off these substances, there is a safety net for you.
Yeah. And, you know, it seems like if we really took the drug problem seriously in the United States, we would be looking to those kind of alternatives and solutions to, you know, what's going to be really effective at getting people to quit drugs. It's not, you know, it's... It seems like it's not so much a problem with, you know, people having problems that they can't handle. It's a problem of supply and demand. We have the supply. the supply is coming in from who knows where. It's not the people necessarily in the ghettos who are supplying this stuff. It comes from somewhere else.
Well, yeah, we know it comes from the opium warlords in Afghanistan, who we helped put in power. And historically, and the movie does a great job of looking at that, is often the drug trade follows so-called U.S. assets, allies we want in wars in the Third World, where we look the other way or allow the transshipment of opiums into the United States. And often, well, the former governor of New Mexico, I believe, was very progressive on a lot of these issues. And by progressive, we mean he took a European approach.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, why do you suppose there's so much difference in harm reduction in Western Europe and the European Union and so little reception to it in the United States?
Well, that's a good question. I just have to posit an explanation. It seems to me that there has been a tremendous engine behind prohibition going back probably before the Nixon administration, but you know, they probably crystallized it right about that time with the Controlled Substances Act of 1970 that placed, you know, cannabis and other drugs within this highly, highly, highly restricted Schedule One. Making them just off limits to everybody. Well, except the drug dealers, you know.
Well, no, it's really odd. I remember back there in the mid-70s getting my copy of Rolling Stone. And again, the son of President Gerry Ford was on the cover in bare feet and pronounced the best place to smoke dope was the White House because the Secret Service protected you. And, you know, having been in college in the 70s and in high school, in the early 70s, it was really difficult to be busted for, you know, small amounts of marijuana. I mean, you know, if you had a... and then all of a sudden Reagan came along and the drug policies shifted dramatically. They were seizing yachts for two joints, for God's sake.
Right. Well, that was my memory of it, you know, as a person probably about your same age, you know, having grown up, you know, come of age in the 70s and remembering these different people, that it seemed to me that when Reagan was elected in 1980, and particularly in the early 80s, 1981, 82, all of a sudden he declared the war on drugs, you know, started paraquating all the cannabis that was growing in Mexico or whatever, and it just seemed to take off. And honestly, I know that goes back to Nixon as the origin, but in my worldview, it seemed to me like it was Reagan that really kicked off the war on drugs.
Well, that whole bureaucracy and seizing stuff and, you know, the spoils of it, where it really seemed to become big business. And by the way, his daughter, Patty Davis, said that Reagan at least once smoked pot with a major donor, and that she used to grow pot. She used to live with Bernie Ledden of the Eagles and used to say that her father would warn her, yeah. Say, I hope none of your friends are growing that pot. And she was like, thanks, Dad.
Well, you know, it's too bad because, you know, Reagan didn't stick with his pot smoking. It was used, yeah. I think, in 2002, Alzheimer's was added to the list of conditions for which cannabis is treated in Oregon. And it's shown a lot of promise. In fact, there's a researcher at Ohio State University who's been looking into Alzheimer's, he's doing rat studies. It's hard to get a hands on cannabis, mm-hmm. because there's the restrictions on research. But he's doing rat studies with synthetic THC and finding that it does retard the progression of Alzheimer's. So, sure, I think Reagan should have kept up with his pot smoking.
Might have helped him as he suffered from the advanced stages of Alzheimer's.
So I'll do a quick station ID. This is Fight Back with Bob Fitrakis and Connie Goodell Newton. This is WCRS 98.3 in Grandview, Ohio State, and 102.1 Easton. And we have Mary Jane Borden, the editor of Drug War Facts, with us as our guest tonight. Check out the website, www.drugwarfacts.org. You were just talking about medical marijuana you were talking about research into the benefits. So that kind of brings me into medical marijuana. In order to get legislation passed, it seems like the research is pretty important. What kinds of restrictions on research are there?
Well, I was looking, it's interesting because I was looking today, you go to pubmed.gov, which is the National Institute of Medicine's website that contains all the research studies. So you go to pubmed.gov and you do a search on cannabis or cannabinoids, and you'll come back with 12,000 hits. In other words, there's 12,000 different research studies out there that deal somehow with cannabis or with cannabinoids. Now, cannabinoid is a component of cannabis. It's a a scientific name for the components of cannabis, and I think there's something like 60 or more cannabinoids within the cannabis plant. So and I looked at that, and some of the studies I found that, for example, if you narrow your search and you do a search on cannabinoids in cancer, you'll get 714 hits, and you're going to come up with studies. I'm going to read a couple of these. The endogenous cannabinoid anamidine induces COX-2-dependent cell death in apoptosis-resistant colon cancer cells. That's the name of the study.
What does that basically mean?
It cures colon cancer. Oh, exactly. Great. The effect of synthetic cannabinoid effect of synthetic cannabinoid agonist on the proliferation and invasion of gastric cancer cells. Okay? Again, we're looking at cancer. Spinal and peripheral analgesic effects of the CBD cannabinoid receptor agonist, AM1241, and 2 miles of bone cancer-induced pain. Cannabis can be used to treat bone cancer pain. What we're finding now, when we were starting to hear from the government a few years ago, there's no research that supports the use of cannabis in medicine. Now, what I'm reading here, we're not talking about anecdotal reports. The college used to complain that patients would talk about these anecdotal reports. These are scientific studies that are on PubMed.gov. You can go look them up yourself, and you'll have to read all the scientific wording and stuff that kind of makes it hard to understand. The summary of it is that cannabis is showing great promise in killing cancer cells associated with colon cancer, with breast cancer.
Okay, so it's not just pain control is what you're saying. It's not just nausea or pain control, that it actually reverses cancer?
Yeah, it's apoptosis is basically the killing of cancer cells.
Okay. So it's not just pain management, or keep your, smoke pot or take some THC or something to get your appetite back so that you can kind of deal with the symptoms of cancer. It's actually going to the cancer cells itself.
It kills cancer. Okay, short version. The cannabinoids, particularly the CBD cannabinoid, kills cancer cells. All right.
Well, I noticed in the movie they looked like news references that there was some studies indicating it may help with brain cancer, which some would argue, thanks to the cell phone industry, may be peaking.
Well, that's interesting there, because Senator Kennedy died late last year of brain cancer. I think it was called a glioma, something, if I pronounced that correctly. That, again, the CBD cannabinoid has been shown to kill.
So if you're at high risk for brain cancer because you're a politician and you're always on your cell phone, you should definitely smoke a lot of pot to reduce your risk. It's a pretty bad risk factor if you're a politician.
Smoking the pot would also lead to much better social policies. They would be pondering.
So it would reduce everybody's risk.
They would be thinking, whoa, $750 billion in debt. It's like too big a number. Lower it. And they would let all the people who smoked pot and the people that are addicted out of jail, because they'd realize that it's a medical problem, because THC, in many cases, stimulates thought. So, of course, it's hard to imagine worse policies at this point in history. Mm-hmm. So it may be, smoking banana peels would help them as well. We got the 5-minute mark. Let's ask Mary Jane. You got a long list there. Some facts you want to share with us that we can respond to?
Well, one of the things I have here sitting in front of me here is a flyer I created. I call it From the Chapters of Drug War Facts. And because Drug War Facts is basically, as you see in the book, divided down into chapters. And the particular chapter that we're talking about on this flyer is economics. And let me read a couple of things from here. $714 billion, 2010. That's the size of the federal budget deficit, all right, just this past April. And this is, remember, these all come from reports from the government. We're not talking about something that we made up here. These can also all be accessed online at Drug War Facts. You go to the economics section or go to any section. You will find and can click on the actual report that supports this particular fact. So you can look it up for yourself. All right. So let me go on here. $48.7 billion in 2008. That's the cost of drug prohibition. Okay, that's what it costs. You know, $33 billion in state and local governments could save. Legalization could result $23 billion from legalization of cocaine and heroin. $13 billion savings from legalization of marijuana. Let's go on. It cost $6.2 billion in 2007 to imprison drug offenders, just to keep them in jail. All right. It cost. Let's go back to Afghanistan. The counter-narcotics programs in Afghanistan have been $2 billion from 2005 to 2009. All right? Things you might think are kind of silly, stupid. $1.7 billion from 1998 to 2010 to influence adolescents in the media to not do drugs. You know those great, wonderful commercials of your brain on drugs? Okay, there's your money. There's your tax
with
dollars
the egg
at work.
Cracking.
Yeah. Another one, and wiretap devices, you know, they talked about in the movie, for example, how no cell phone is safe. Well, that's $7.8 million in 2007. All right, and this is what I think is one of the most important statistics on this list. And it's $1.4 billion, and that's in 2009. That's the revenue that California loses because it... because marijuana is illegal in California. Now, if you follow this issue, you'll know that there's a initiative on the ballot for this fall in California called Tax Cannabis 2010. And that initiative, which if it passes the voters, will make marijuana legal in the state of California. You know, possession of, I don't think it's 2 ounces or under, don't quote me on that. And it'll also allow local municipalities to collect tax revenue. So we're starting to see a sea of change here. And it's predicted, of course, that if Tax Cannabis 2010 passes in California this fall, it might be the tipping point for the whole drug war.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems like the other states could want to rush to catch up on that because it seems like there could be a lot of tourism into California. And that I don't know if that's accurate, but
well,
it
further
seems
to
like
that,
a lot of people could just flock in there, and that the other states might want to catch up.
Well, further to that, California and other states, Ohio's among them, have these $1 billion budget deficits, and I think it's $6 to $10 billion in California. So California's at the situation now, like, where can we get some money? You know, well, let's look to drugs.
And, of course, they looked at that with the pharmaceuticals. So, I mean, a lot of studies have always indicated that the vast majority of drug addiction is from legally prescribed drugs that are legally manufactured and often misused. But there's always been this obsession with the illegal drugs when, you know, essentially we have synthetic heroin and OxyContin.
Why is that? Well, that's kind of a weird thing that I don't quite understand because my background, I spent 10 years in the pharmaceutical industry and now I've spent 10 years not in the illegal drug industry, no, certainly not on the illegal side of it, but in advocated for sensible drug policies. And so I see drugs from a holistic standpoint. I don't see the distinction between this illegal marijuana, cocaine, heroin, et cetera, and the Zoloft, you know, OxyContin, et cetera. Because, you know, what we're doing now, because of the clinical studies that are showing the potential for cannabinoids and also for the potential, therapeutic potential for LSD and MDMA and drugs like that, the lines are clearly blurring.
I saw a great commercial that reminded me of some of the tactics that, like, quote-unquote drug dealers use. It was for legal drugs. It was a sleeping pill. It was a commercial that was on late at night. So it was marketed, I guess, to people who can't sleep. And it said, call us for a free trial. They gave a 1-800 number and said, you can get a free trial. And then, oh, FYI, warning, this is addictive. It said it gave the side effects and it said that it could be addictive. And so I actually called the 800 number to complain that that they were using drug dealer tactics. That they were basically trying to get people hooked. I don't know.
Ah, the free sample. Just free like sample. The Chambers Brothers in Detroit used to. You know, the first
good
heroin
marketing
was always free.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up here. And we want to thank Mary Jane
Thank
Borden
you so much for
and
coming
Drug
on
War Facts,
to the show.
And we want you to go to drugwarfacts. Is it .org?
.org.
Drugwarfacts.org. And remember, always investigate the facts.
This has been Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3 Grandview, 102.1 Easton.